And we want to welcome you to a special edition of the Fifth Estate podcast. This is we're going to do a 9/11 retrospective. I'm Jake Russo. I'm here with Neil Dewing. Neil, how are you doing today?
Doing okay, Jay. Doing okay. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
It's been 15 years since September 11th, 2001. And, I don't know about you, but I like to take time on this day every year to remember what happened and remember the lives that were lost in New York and in Washington, D.C. and in a field in Pennsylvania,
right,
on Flight 93. And this is the thing. It never seems to ever stop feeling like immediate.
Mm-hmm.
I watch the footage and I watch and I see the images, and it all always every year comes flooding back. And I've been waiting for 10 years or so for it to stop feeling like that, but it hasn't yet. Have you had that experience?
No, it's still heart-wrenching every time it's funny, I don't look at anything throughout the year, but when it does come around to this, the anniversary date, I will usually watch some of the things that I try to avoid. And
yeah.
No, it feels immediate. It's hard to believe it's 15 years ago, because it's still, every time you think about it, it just feels like it just recently happened.
It truly does. It truly does. And it seems like the last few years, I always find something new that I haven't seen before, some new footage or photographs, or read some new account that I haven't read before, that it all just rips open that wound.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it is a wound that we all have kind of suffered as Americans. Some people, I think, maybe don't feel it as much as others. Some people bury it down, but I think it's probably the last time as a country that we were all sort of on the same page.
Yeah, there was no, aside from, outliers, I mean, there was really no politics for a while.
I mean, like, I very clearly remember weeks, months after this attack, people had the little American flag that they stuck in their windows in their cars. Mm-hmm. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
Those were everywhere.
Yep.
Everybody had them, and nobody wanted to take them out of their car window. Nobody wanted to – there were these little flags that just fluttered in the breeze as you drove down the road, but nobody wanted to take them out, even as they started to get all ratty and torn, and they would fly off on the highway. Nobody wanted to take them out of their window. And I don't know if they sort of felt like if they took that out, that would be this moment, this rare moment of unity and togetherness with the country. I don't know if they felt like that maybe that would be going away, because it certainly has.
Right. And it certainly has. And I was watching, one of the things that I like to watch, because, it's so terrible, but then there's some uplifting stuff. And one of the more uplifting mm-hmm. things was the 2001 World Series, where George W. Bush went out to the mound at Yankee Stadium, stood out there by himself, alone.
Yeah.
And, there's a little bit of a backstory to it, where he wanted to warm up. And so he went in the kind of the bowels of Yankee Stadium, and they have like a pitching mound in there. And Derek Jeter came walking in and said, so, Mr. President, where are you going to throw from? Where are you going to pitch it from? And President Bush had said initially he was going to kind of throw from the base of the mound. And Derek Jeter warned him and said, you don't want to do that. You want to throw from the rubber on the mound. They're going to boo you if you don't. And so the president was like, okay, makes me a little bit more nervous now, but I'll do that. And he goes, and George W. Bush is relaying the story. He goes, and as he's walking out, he kind of looks over his shoulder and he says, oh, by the way, don't bounce it, because they'll boo you. So, and then they show the footage. He walks out there, Yankee Stadium is just going absolutely crazy. And this is New York. I mean, it's obviously, if it was any other time, the president goes out to a ball game, people are going to boo. It's just, hey, sure, we get a chance to boo the president. But he walked out there to cheers, and then he stood there looking around, and he did this kind of thumbs up thing, and crowd went absolutely wild. And then he goes and throws from the rubber and throws a strike.
He just rolled it in there.
Yeah, just kind of, and not kind of like lobbing it or whatever. He had good form and everything. It's like he paid attention. He knew what might happen. So so that kind of thing is fun to watch. But what. If we go back on it, a lot of people don't know us. They don't know what was going on. So tell us where you were, and what you remember about that day.
I was a senior in high school, I remember not really thinking it was any kind of special day, as just about everybody thought. I went to school, and my first period class, I think I had a study hall at the time that the first plane hit. So being something of a juvenile delinquent, I was, instead of in study hall, I was roaming around the school alone, unsupervised. And I remember I walked by the office, and the atmosphere was strange. Something was different. And I remember very clearly one of my teachers, he was a Vietnam veteran, he busted out the back door of the office building, and he was just muttering something about, these bastards, we're going to turn them into a glass sandbox. And I was like, what is going on? I didn't put it all together right then, because he was kind of a nut. But went into the office, and I saw on the TV, I saw that the towers were on fire. I mean, this had been going on for some time now. I had been unaware. And it was quickly made clear to me, just from watching the footage, that this was a very serious thing. This was a terrorist attack. My headmaster was there, and the dean. And so, we were watching it on the television, and I remember the towers fell, and the enormity of it sort of hit me. This is really happening. There are people dying in those buildings. There are people on the ground who are dying. And the rest of the day was just sort of passing a fog, nobody was doing any schoolwork. I mean, everybody was glued to the televisions in every classroom, just watching the news and waiting for some sort of developments, as the day wore on, trying to figure out what had happened. They finally sent us home, and still just watching the news. I think I watched television all night and into the early morning. I just couldn't look away from it. Just could not stop watching them try to figure out what had happened, and watching people react to the towers falling and to the Pentagon being hit, and to the news about Flight 93, and wondering when it was going to stop. Basically watching the TV, waiting for the next one, and the next one, and the next one, waiting for it. But I remember very clearly, I was still at school, and I was with a buddy, and we were in the parking lot listening on the radio to the coverage. And I remember turning to him and saying, this is going to be the major event of our life. This is going to define our generation. Even then, as a 17-year-old knucklehead, I grasped that this was tremendous in a way that nothing in my life had ever been that big before. It was just this very strange sense of confusion and powerlessness and fear, and wondering what came next for the country and for myself and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was. I have a kind of more of a personal relationship with the whole thing. I'm originally from New York, and I worked in Manhattan for about 4 years, and I worked in the World Financial Center. I worked right across the street. I was in the World Trade Center every day. I took the PATH train from Newark into the World Trade Center. And if you've never been there, and a lot of people haven't, some people have, it's like you can't get a sense of the enormity of the size of these buildings unless you're actually inside of them. They are just, they were just just gigantic. And, the thing was, it was where I lived, even when I moved over to New Jersey when I was younger, it was like you go up the New Jersey Turnpike and it's like those twin towers were just like this kind of like, there was this bookends. There was, Midtown, there was the Empire State Building, and down Lower Manhattan, you would always see the twin towers. And I remember going back to 1993 with the World Trade Center bombing, and like a day later or whatever, and seeing no power in the World Trade Center, like all the lights off. And I thought that was bad, that looked bad. So I was in Florida. I'd moved to Florida by the time the attacks happened, and I was at work, and we didn't have any televisions in the offices where I worked, so all we were hearing were things on the radio. And they had said a plane had hit the World Trade Center. Now, my initial thought was, when you're there, you always see kind of like little Cessnas and things flying around across the Hudson River or something, and somebody just kind of screwed up, and this, I'm figuring a little plane crashed into the World Trade Center. The idea that it was a passenger jet never even occurred to me.
Right.
And then we were kind of listening, and then of course the second plane hit, and that's when we kind of knew that something bad was happening. The worst part was when I had heard somebody said that, they were still listening to the radio, and somebody said the tower fell. Now, initially, my thought was, I'm sitting there thinking on top of one of the towers was a huge antenna, for broadcasting and things. I thought for a second that's what they were talking about. Like, that had fallen over or something. There was something, enough impact that forced that to fall. And I didn't realize when they said the tower fell, they were actually talking about one of the actual towers had collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became clear that that's what had happened. And I thought, my God, what's going to happen here? And then it wasn't too long before we heard about the second one falling. I mean, you think about it, the first plane hit the North Tower at 8:45, and by 10:30, both of the towers had collapsed. That's all it took, was an hour and 45 minutes for this.
It's a miracle they lasted that long.
Yeah, it is. And it's also a miracle, believe it or not, the fact that it's obviously thousands of lives is not, something to sit there and sneeze at, but it could have been so much more. The first estimates, people were concerned there might have been 10,000-15,000 people that might have died. People are saying it's a miracle that not that many more died, and a lot of people attribute it to the fact of the early 93 bombing, that as soon as somebody saw something, a lot of people said, we're out of here. Even when they were saying, right, it's safe to go back upstairs, they were like, nope, we're going, there's no way I'm sticking around here. The other thing was that I remember is, this was still at a time. This is before the smartphone. This was before, this is at a time in 2001 where people were just starting to get high-speed internet, and when news websites and everything couldn't handle the traffic. So I remember this clearly: CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, even the Drudge Report, all those sites down, just down from the massive amount of traffic of people trying to get to these sites to kind of get some information, because there was no social media. There was no sharing. And it was funny. I was talking to somebody about that, and I said, I'm almost glad it didn't happen in the age of social media and home and, everybody having video and photographs and everything like that, because it would become saturated. You talk about the images that we see that we're used to seeing, they still have that kind of, I don't necessarily say shock value, but something that really tugs at you emotionally. And I think it's because it wasn't oversaturated, that we still get to be reminded vividly of what had happened. There was a tourist that actually shot, you know, one of the videos of the second plane crashing into the South Tower. I don't even think they were, you know, they were there in I guess they were in Battery Park City from where they shot it. And it was just, you know, it's horrifying. You hear this plane and all of a sudden you see it come in into the frame and for about a second and a half before it crashes into the tower. And so, you know, I'm kind of glad that it wasn't like that. There is some of these stories that are still told that are still harrowing. CNN had a really interesting kind of interactive thing that they did the other day where there was that some of the raw footage that hadn't been released before by the documentary crew they were doing a documentary on firemen, on rookie firemen, and they actually had caught kind of a little bit of the plane striking the North Tower. And so they went down there, and on that CNN thing, I've never seen this video before. They're sitting there as the South Tower starts to collapse, and you see them running, and you hear this sound, which sounds like an earthquake, and there's light. And then 2 seconds later, it's completely dark because of the smoke and everything. When they finally come out of where they were going up the stairs, it looks like a post-apocalyptic world that they stepped into.
It does. And going back and watching footage like that, it takes on a different element. When we saw the towers go down in real time, it was terrifying. It was scary. But when you go back and you watch the footage of the men in those buildings who don't know what's about to happen, who might intellectually grasp that this will happen eventually, but don't know that in 5 minutes' time, several of them will be dead, mm-hmm. or they'll be trapped. That takes on an aspect of horror. And it never quite lets up.
Right.
That's my experience. I know that CNN thing that you're talking about, I haven't watched it because I got to the part where they're in the lobby and I had to click away from it,
mm-hmm.
because of that horror. And maybe later when I can properly process it, I'll watch it.
But yeah, there's it's on YouTube. I had watched it. I think I watched it once, and I could not bear to watch it again. Somebody had timed, it was a 911 call, and this gentleman was speaking to the 911 dispatcher. He was on the South Tower, like on the 101st floor, and they just had like the video, the kind of still camera shot of the South Tower as it burned, and he kind of synced the tower and the moment it collapsed, that this guy was still on the phone with the 911 dispatcher when the tower started to collapse. He was telling them who he was, where they were, how many people were there. Hey, are they going to come get us? And you hear this rumble and you hear him say, "Oh God." And then like, you hear him start to scream and then it cuts off. And so like they actually caught on this call, the beginning of the tower beginning to collapse. And it's horrifying to hear because you can hear the fear in his voice. He knows what's happening. He's seeing it as he's on the phone, and then it just cuts off, and it's just like, oh my God, I can't even imagine what he was thinking at that moment or what he was going through at that moment.
You know, and that's horrifying enough. And then you think of the people who were burning alive and who launched themselves into the air just to escape the flames.
Right.
And who fell. And I don't know how many there were. I think I've heard like dozens, maybe a dozen.
Yeah, there may be more than that. I think there was something they said like 1,000 people that died, but they never found the remains simply because they were just either incinerated or they were just crushed by debris and they couldn't find anything. So
I mean, it's truly just a horrific spectacle, and it's one of those things where some people might question, well, why do that to yourself? Why, you know, why lacerate yourself every year watching this? And I think it's important that we watch it. And I think it's important that we feel this horror, because if we forget, then it'll make it that much easier for it to happen to us again.
Yeah. And I had gone, it's funny, I was there. It was funny. I was there in New York in 2000. I went to visit my brother who lived in New Jersey at the time. So I was there in 2000, and then the attacks happened, and I got to go back in 2002 for a business trip. And I went downtown, and it was still, at that point, they weren't really doing any construction. It was still cleanup. And it was just, you know, it was hard to see. You know, again, I worked there, and you know, I saw like the big huge glass facade that the World Financial Center had, that was still just kind of like, you know, a big hole, and the damage that was done to some of the other buildings from the debris, and you just, there was just this, again, this hole, it's just like this giant hole in the ground, and so it was tough to watch. And then a couple of years ago, when I went to New York City on vacation, I got a chance to go to the memorial and see the reflecting pools. And also just, I took a couple of pictures of the new Freedom Tower. And to me, I just thought it was great. It was beautiful to see the memorial and to kind of see the names there, but to kind of see that the building was rebuilt, like they'd, you know, rebuilt around this.
Right.
And said, you know, screw you, we're not going to be afraid, and we're going to rebuild. And here it is. And it's just, it's kind of inspiring. And if you get to go there, and you've just been there recently, it's really great to see.
We were in New York last week, and we visited this site, and it was my first time going there. And I didn't want to go, actually. I wanted to avoid it while we were there, but my wife, you know, kind of insisted that we go, and I'm glad I went. But it's just, I look at the tower, and it's inspiring, and you know, we rebuilt. And then I look at the reflecting pools, and there's just these vast empty spaces there. And I just, it's just this sadness mixed with a sort of impotent rage, you know, mm-hmm. because the men who did this, the ideology that was behind this, has not been defeated. It's still out there. It's still right. A threat. You know, if you think about 15 years ago when this happened, this is longer than any conflict America has ever been in, you know, from Pearl Harbor. In December of 1941, we were at war with Japan and Germany until 1945. So 42, 43, 44, and half of 45. So 3.5 years of war. And it was a very different kind of war, but it was also a war that we indisputably won. There are no more Nazis. The Empire of Japan is no longer the same entity that it was after we were finished with them.
Right.
We have not had that moment in the intervening 15 years. Yeah, we killed bin Laden. That's great. It felt good. But the threat was bigger than bin Laden, you know?
Right.
And so when I looked at that memorial and I saw that vast empty space, I got no comfort from it. I could just not derive any satisfaction or peace from looking at that empty space and knowing that what put that empty space there is still circling around us, threatening us. And I don't know if we know how to fix it. I really don't. but it's a bigger problem than me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's obviously something, again, cause we're not fighting a country, where there's an obvious enemy that can surrender. You know, this is kind of like a faceless enemy, almost an enemy with no nation. I think the only thing that we can probably take some solace in is that because of the efforts of the Bush administration, even the Obama administration with intelligence and with the military, is that there has been no large scale attacks in those 15 years. And that's the reason why they are now going to these kind of smaller, centralized, lone wolf type of attack, simply because they don't have the capacity, the money, or the infrastructure to carry out a major attack like that. And I guess that's something to be thankful for, but the ideology, like you said, is still there. So it's just got to be waged on a whole different front at this point. So we had asked people to email us and, you know, if they had any thoughts about, you know, that day and where they were and anything. And so we got a few, and we're going to read them here, and then Neil's going to kind of close out with something that we both read, which was really nice, and then we'll end the show from there. But I'm going to go ahead and read one here from first from, I don't know if she pronounces her name Rana or Rona McNamara, and she says, on the morning of 9/11, my husband was at his office in Midtown Manhattan. I was at my office in New Jersey. Once we knew it was happening, my husband and two friends of mine who also worked in Manhattan walked to the apartment of one of my friends. My husband, Michael, and my friend, Michelle, had to figure out a way to get home to New Jersey. We only had sporadic cell service, so I only knew from time to time where they were and what they were doing. At around noon, they walked from the Upper West Side down to the ferry terminal, which was jammed with others trying to get back to New Jersey. The bridges and tunnels were all closed, so the water was the only way out. Good Samaritans were actually handing out water bottles to commuters trying to get into the ferries because it was quite warm on that beautiful afternoon. They eventually made it to the ferry in Weehawken. From Weehawken, my husband walked to Hoboken to wait for a train home. I picked him up at our train station around 8:30 p.m. It had taken him from about 10:30 a.m. when he left his office until then to make his way home. I had spent most of the day either glued to the television, mesmerized by the carnage being broadcast live, or trying to reach Michael on his cell phone to be sure that he was safe. Early the next morning, I drove my husband to the park and ride where he had left his car. There were so many cars still there from the day before, and it gave us chills to wonder whether the owners of those cars were ever coming back for them. It still seems like only yesterday. She's another one who just, it doesn't seem like it was long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Rana, however you say your name. We apologize, but we appreciate you sending that in. That's a chilling, chilling thing. If you remember, you know, the flyers of the missing.
Yes.
Just people who were desperately looking for their loved ones in the aftermath. And, you know, they never found some of them.
Right.
So it's, yeah. So I'll read another one. This one is from Bella Gersten. My memory of 9/11 is like a vivid nightmare that I can never shake. I was 22 years old and a stay-at-home mom to my 18-month-old daughter. We lived in Loudoun County, Virginia, along the Potomac River, and my husband was at work in Bethesda, Maryland, which borders Washington, D.C. I was in the basement folding laundry and watching the morning news while my daughter was playing with her toys beside me. I remember watching the first tower engulfed in smoke and the newscasters scrambling for answers. That's when I saw the second tower hit by a plane in real time. All hell broke loose. This was no accident. It was intentional. And living in such close proximity to Washington, D.C., we were in a minefield of targets. I grabbed my baby girl and prayed to the Virgin for protection. I was in full panic mode. With reports of a plane heading down the Potomac River, I was sure that either I would become a widow and my child an orphan, or that it was my time and there would be nothing I could do to protect my baby. By the grace of God, my husband arrived home safe and sound. It was that night that we decided to have another child, and 9 months later, in June of 2002, we were blessed with another beautiful baby girl. Whenever I look at my daughters, I am reminded of the terror of it all. But more importantly, I am reminded of God's grace. Thank you, Bella.
That's...
It reminds me of just the uncertainty, you know?
Yep.
And we still see this sort of amplified now, I think, whenever there's some sort of mass shooting or anything with social media, false reports, you know?
Right.
Idle speculation, you know, back in 2001, it was harder for that stuff to spread. But I remember 2001, nobody knew what was happening.
Right. Nobody knew what was happening. And there were reports of like a bomb going off at the State Department, things of that nature that turned right. out to be not to be true. But it was, you know, this stuff was happening in real time. And it was just, you know, you can kind of almost understand that there might be some stuff that gets reported that really wasn't happening, considering all that they had seen live. Going on. All right, so we have one more email, and this one is from, well, I don't know if he wants me to say his whole name or not. I'm just going to say his last name. It's Madnorsky. Okay. And this email really jumped out at me, and you know, I think everyone's going to find it pretty interesting. So he says, most Americans who are of a certain age, I can remember that day more vividly than yesterday. I was a 19-year-old paratrooper stationed in Georgia. Our battalion was the ready unit for our regiment, meaning we were ready to deploy anywhere in the world within 24 hours. And so my platoon was doing some on-site training. We didn't see any of the initial news reports. We heard bits and pieces of what was happening throughout the morning, and eventually we were called in for a briefing. The emotions that swept through that briefing were so raw. The sorrow for the deaths of our countrymen, the fear for our loved ones, the anger at those who had done this, and the resolve and excitement knowing that we would be at the tip of the spear of any response. A month later, elements of our battalion would be the first to jump into Afghanistan and fire the opening shots of the global war on terror. 15 years and 31 deaths later, my unit is still fighting and taking casualties in that country. Today on 9/11, I still feel that mixed bag of emotion, sorrow for the loss and my countrymen and brothers, pride in my generation who answered the call to service, and fear that America has largely forgotten, as well as bewilderment that 15 years later, we are still fighting and dying with no end in sight. And I don't know who it was that said, but this may be a battle that's it's not going to have finality in terms of, again, somebody declaring that they're surrendering.
No, they never will.
That it's going to be a perpetual fight until, you know, this world decides to end, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's just going to be one of those things where, but that's the whole point about resolve, in that because there is not going to be anyone who's going to surrender in this, that we can't become complacent, which is easy to do.
It is, and you know, we've seen a little bit of that. People want to be done with war. People, especially Americans, we don't do this historically. You know, our country, we had, you know, seasonal wars. We had Indian fighting. We had brief, intense conflicts that concluded mostly to our benefit for the first two centuries of our existence as a country. But this one, even more so than a conflict like the Vietnam War and the larger war against communism, global conflict, this one has no end in sight, because we... You know, if you say we're fighting a religion, you get in trouble. But we are, and that may be a perverted vision of this religion. It may be a truer vision of this religion. I'm not qualified to say, but we are fighting people motivated by religion. And that is just not going to disappear if we bomb enough people or kill enough people. You know, you can dismantle a nation's ability to conduct war by bombing its factories and its roads and you know, killing enough of its soldiery, but you can't do that with a religious conflict.
Right.
You really can't. There's just no end in sight. So I feel for these guys who have been fighting this war, you know, multiple generations of the military, you know, careers start and end in the course of this war. Somebody who enlisted on September 10th, 2001 is 5 years away from retirement and getting a pension,
yep,
doing a full military career. And their entire career would be spent on this conflict. That's not something we've seen before in this country, I don't think.
No. Nope. All right.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mad Norsky, for sending that in. That's definitely, you know, a good perspective to consider. And thank you, everybody else who sent in your thoughts and remembrances. That was much appreciated.
Yeah, so let's, you were going to read something here as a quote, pretty long quote, and we're just going to close out the show when you're finished with that. So we appreciate you listening. And
And I'll try to keep it together in the course of this thing, but maybe we can, if I get all weepy, we can fix it in post, right?
Yeah, we can do that.
This is a quote by David Bentley Hart, and it's something that I actually came across in the Transom newsletter this morning, and it's pretty affecting. Ours is, after all, a religion of salvation. Our faith is in a God who has come to rescue his creation from the absurdity of sin and the emptiness of death. And so we are permitted to hate these things with a perfect hatred. For while Christ takes the suffering of his creatures up into his own, it is not because he or they had need of suffering, but because he would not abandon his creatures to the grave. And while we know that the victory over evil and death has been won, we know also that it is a victory yet to come, and that creation, therefore, as Paul says, groans in expectation of the glory that will one day be revealed. Until then, the world remains a place of struggle between light and darkness, truth and falsehood, life and death. And in such a world, our portion is charity. As for comfort, when we seek it, I can imagine none greater than the happy knowledge that when I see the death of a child, I do not see the face of God, but the face of his enemy. It is not a faith that would necessarily satisfy Ivan Karamazov, but neither is it one that his arguments can defeat, for it has set us free from optimism and taught us hope instead. We can rejoice that we are saved not through the imminent mechanisms of history and nature, but by grace, that God will not unite all of history's many strands in one great synthesis, but will judge much of history false and damnable, that he will not simply reveal the sublime logic of fallen nature, but will strike off the fetters in which creation languishes, and that rather than showing us how the tears of a small girl suffering in the dark were necessary for the building of the kingdom, he will instead raise her up and wipe away all tears from her eyes. And there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, nor any more pain, for the former things will have passed away. And he that sits upon the throne will say, "Behold, I make all things new."